As a matter of fact, one of the accusations against the Christians was that they were incestuous because they called their wife their sister. You know, so they're considered cannibals because they ate their master, and they were incestuous because they married their sister. Mm-hmm. You know, so you see how odd that the Christians mm-hmm. are seen by people, especially if they had left the pagan practices to go. So within the church, then, somebody who teaches that the gospel accommodates participation in these practices, someone who teaches that would be a popular teacher, you know, because they're alleviating a ton of suffering that's associated with it.
Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast. I'm Kent.
And I'm Nathan.
And what we're trying to do is recover faith by recovering the faith. And we're in a series called The Voice of the Shepherd. We're trying to understand what it means to follow the voice of Jesus, follow the gospel in daily life. So we're looking at the New Testament and examining how they did it in order to learn from them. And we've done a few episodes in this series, and today we're going to pick up with the body ethic. All right? And Nathan's going to talk to us about what he means by that.
Nathan. Yeah. Yeah. You go to a lot of directions with it. So we've talked some about Paul's instructions, say, on morality and sexuality. And so he couches his ethic on sexuality, at least in one place, in 1 Corinthians 6, where there's a very direct and specific prohibition against, porneia, which in the old translations was fornication.
Mm.
Don't you fornicate around here, boy. Yeah, we're against fornication, Californication, all of the fornications, they're bad. That was a translation of porneia, which most newer translations translate sexual immorality and could potentially mean lots of things. Paul's specific prohibition in 1 Corinthians 6, in verse, beginning of verse 15, is really against being a John, I guess, visiting a prostitute or taking advantage of this, I guess, worship cult that involved prostitution, is what most people think, and a lot of pagan religions, somehow sexual libertinism becomes a part of the worship, which I guess is convenient. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's kind of like when we have a concert for ourselves and we call that worship, and it is, but it has to be a certain quality, you know. The music has to be pleasing to us as well as we hope pleasing to God. The words are pleasing to God, maybe the melodies for us. there are certain things about what we would call worship that we find pleasurable. Certainly nothing as debased or, you know, whatever as these ancients, but it's really common in ancient cultures for there to be a sensuality, I guess, and a focus on sexual libertinism and things like that as a part of worship. So there's that. And Paul speaks of the body in multiple ways in this, his explanation. We've talked about that, you know, they were using logic, I guess, they had an ethic behind their argument for sexual libertinism. And, you know, we would think, let's say you lived in Nevada, okay, and you found out that it was just really common, you know, for the guys in your church to have these men's retreats at a brothel.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be like, say what now? Mm-hmm. You know, for us, that would just be like so just way beyond the pale, right? Mm-hmm. But this was that prostitution and this, it was a lifestyle in that you would visit the pagan temple, you know, be a part of that, those rituals that included prostitution with males and females. And that was, I don't know, it was like bowling league. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't something for somebody who was coming out of paganism. It wasn't something that they were thinking, this is horrific, you know, that this is so deeply wrong that no one would ever even consider this. It would be unconscionable for a Christian to do this. I mean, for them, this was just, you know, it was like if I had made the case that the gospel, you know, let's say something that's maybe less than ideal. So let's stay with the Nevada thing and say it's, you know, gambling. Let's just say that gambling is a common thing. Everybody does on the weekend. Mm-hmm. And so now you're a Christian and somebody tells you, well, you know, we don't gamble now. And you're like, why? You know, and so you might think, well, that, you know, it's silly. It's just, it's recreation. It's what we do. And they seem to have that kind of a mentality that there was an ethic behind this, kind of excusing this practice. And this crops up again and again. I think we fail to appreciate how entrenched these practices were in the lifestyle of the pagan people, so that it, like, not going to the pagan temple was just so very odd that you would be, like, excluded from polite society or something, you know? Not participating in these sexual practices would just make you very strange.
So this is something that is sanctioned by society, not something that's condemned by society. It's sanctioned by society. Right. It's expected. Mm-hmm. It's normal.
Right. And so if you can imagine that there's this real kind of pressure to do this thing, you know, to participate in this with other people. Maybe you're, let's say you're, rather than a church retreat, let's say it's a work retreat. Mm-hmm. You know, that your work retreat, one of the things that they do every year is they'll go down to the pagan temple and everybody has a good time. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's just something you do. And if you want to be promoted in your company, then you're a part of this. Mm-hmm. If you want to be excluded or relegated to menial jobs, marginalized, and you know, not part of the direction of the company, then you would avoid it. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can avoid it once and say, well, you know, I don't feel well, or I've got a conflict. Okay, but next year, see you there, right? And, you know, you go on long enough, and then you're just really not a part of the group. And that was, I think that was the case, because people's work, religious, and recreational lives were all kind of woven together around the pagan practices, so that your guild, your work guild, if you were, say, a silversmith or whatever, had a patron deity. You know, so you are part of a work group. Like, everybody in this guild is seen as an accepted artisan, that they are held maybe to a set of standards in their craft, and that legally they are allowed to hang out a shingle and sell silver goods. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that provides some security for those who are in the guild, but it also provides exclusion if you're not, you mm-hmm. know, that you really are not allowed to do this or participate in this if you're not in the guild. Mm-hmm. But the guild is dedicated to pagan deity. And so when I say your work groups go into this as a work retreat, this isn't far-fetched. If the guild is worshiping the deity and the deity's temple has these prostitution, you know, these sexual practices, and that's how you honor your deity, and you're not part of that, you know, you're mm-hmm. now offending the deity. Maybe mm-hmm. the deity doesn't like you now. He doesn't like your guild. Mm-hmm. So the implications just begin to stack up. And I say all this to say that there's a lot of pressure to participate in these practices that wasn't just sexual, although I think it's, you know, there's kind of a, for them, marriage was a place where you had, your wife was to provide children for you, but she may not have been your exclusive sexual partner, and mm-hmm. that might not have been expected. So there were various other sexual outlets or relationships for a man in that society that would be normal, natural, and to break with that would be odd. You know, you would maybe be, there would be suspicion cast. As a matter of fact, one of the accusations against the Christians was that they were incestuous because they called their wife their sister. You know, so they're considered cannibals because they ate their master, and they were incestuous because they married their sister. Mm-hmm. You know, so you see how odd that the Christians are seen by people, especially if they had left the pagan practices to go. So within the church, then, somebody who teaches that the gospel accommodates participation in these practices, someone who teaches that would be a popular teacher, you know, because they're alleviating a ton of suffering that's associated with this. So all that to say is that, you know, we see in Scripture relatively early on that there's a very libertine strain. John speaks of, in Revelation, he speaks of the Nicolaitans, and that there, obviously, there's some sexual libertinism there, especially as he's, you know, he's speaking into the churches and he speaks of certain teachers and that they're following the way of Balaam. And Balaam officially, you know, taught the Israelites that they could have these liaisons with pagan women. And that was his attempt to bring God's disfavor on Israel and thereby destroy them on behalf of the Moabites. Mm. So Balaam is seen as this arch tempter, as a human, as somebody who is seeking to destroy the people of God by encouraging them to participate in wicked practices. Mm-hmm. And that's what Jesus, through John, that's what he associates these teachers with. You know, so as we talk about the gospel as the basis of our ethic, well, we have to be careful that we draw these lines clearly and we're able to exposit the gospel so that we don't come up with convenient interpretations of it that will be like the teachings of Balaam.
Right.
Yes. Yep. And that should make us afraid.
And we would be potentially vulnerable to doing that if we said we're not under law, we're under the gospel, and then we had this truncated gospel that didn't have an ethic.
Right.
That was really that it yields forth.
Right. Yeah. And I think the fact that these heresies spun off, it confirms my thesis that the gospel was the ethic of the early church.
It confirms that they were not living under law, that there weren't these laws to perform. And that then that does make you vulnerable if you don't have a robust gospel.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So we talked about, I don't know if it was last time or two times ago, about the letter in Acts 15 that they, you know, that the apostles wrote and the apostles in Jerusalem wrote to the pagan churches, the people that are the formerly pagan, the churches among the Gentiles, that, you know, there are really three prohibitions, you know, avoid blood, things strangled, and fornication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, okay, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, just pick any three things, right? So this is, you know, prohibition, and it could have been seen as a law. It could have been something that just went everywhere with the gospel. It doesn't seem to have been the case. It seems to have been the necessary separation from paganism, you know, as let's say the Judaizers are coming through and they're saying, how are we going to know who the people of God are? You know, well, you have to be circumcised, you know, just have this one elective surgery. You know, we're not asking that much. It's, you know, it hurts. You'll heal up for a week. It's fine. You know, they made a real decision in Acts 15, though, because that's becoming a cultural Jew, and we don't have to do that. But at the same time, they were like, but you can't just be like the pagans. You have to be different. You're circumcised in a spiritual way from paganism. Mm-hmm. And that would, I guess, maybe brings us back around to this ethic, because while circumcision is a, you know, we've said it's a, The practice of circumcision was a circular cut, a removal of fleshly attachments in every direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then Moses in Deuteronomy tells, you know, says, someday I'm going to circumcise your hearts. After you go into exile and you come back, I'm going to circumcise your hearts. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? I'm going to, you know, I'm going to make a cut on your heart that is going to separate you from attachments that are fleshly. Okay. So that you will just love me. So that there's this devotion that is given to God. Okay. Mm-hmm. So circumcision becomes this this thing that both severs fleshly attachments but signifies a spiritual connection, because everyone who is circumcised is a part of one group of people or one body of mm-hmm. of a new nation. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the irony, that there's this freedom from attachments that makes one included in an organic whole, you know, and it, you know, I guess it's kind of a mystery, right? But to be circumcised is not just about devotion to God or being dedicated to God, but it is about participation and identification with a group. Okay. And so when Paul speaks in, you know, Colossians 2, he says, you've been circumcised with the circumcision of Christ, not made with human hands, but, you know, through the power of the resurrection from, you know, in baptism, and that your, you know, your whole flesh has been put off mm-hmm. through this. So, but this being raised up out of that and being a person who is free now of the flesh, this person is now part of a kingdom, right? And united to a body. So 1 Corinthians 1:13, critically important verse, I think, where he says he has translated us out of the kingdom of darkness and into the kingdom of his son, you know. So there's this new society that we're a part of. And a lot of what Paul teaches is just cultural appropriateness. And how he's like, you're a part of this group. Why, you know, don't behave like that. And I think that that's what those specific instructions in Acts 15 are, just here are the cultural markers that you need at this moment, mm-hmm. you know. And we talked about, you know, Tertullian said, hey, Christians, you know, we don't participate in these pagan practices and we don't expose our children. That there's some distinctives, and there ought to be in every culture. Sometimes those are somewhat culturally bound because maybe there's a particular evil in the society that we've come out of. And that becomes something that begins to define us. Now, that thing, because it defines our old society, may exert particular pressure on us to accommodate. You know, we may not want to be that different. And so I think that's kind of what fornication, sexual immorality was, one of the things that would signify insider status among the pagans, which is why they needed to be free of it, you know, because to not participate in it signifies insider status among God's people or the believers. So he, you know, he talks about this idea that you were washed, you were sanctified in verse 11 of 1 Corinthians 6, you were justified, right? But I want to look at their ethic. Their ethic is twofold. One, everything is lawful. Okay. And I think that they are really using his ethic. Like he'd come through mm-hmm. and taught everything's lawful. I mean, that mm-hmm. was, I think that was an important first lesson, especially as you have a Jew-Gentile group, mm-hmm. you know, that the Jews can't have a list of arbitrary prohibitions that the Gentiles have to follow. If they do, you don't have this coming together of the two into one. You just have an assuming, you know, a full assimilation into one group so that you have uniformity rather than unity. And Paul says, you know, that is not the gospel. Mm-hmm. And this gets back to this body mentality, that the body must be diverse. If the body isn't diverse, it's not a body. Okay. But the body, if the body is not coherent, it's not a body. Right. Mm-hmm. And if the body, and if the members of the body are not individually healthy, then that brings about, you know, a negative impact on the whole body. So that the body is cohesive, but that the members are interdependent and I think aware of one another. So that the body ethic becomes in and of itself. You know, I mean, and I think that Paul gets this largely from this very limited moment in Scripture where there's this pronouncement that, you know, a man will leave his father and his mother, be joined to his wife, the two will be one flesh. We've talked about this, but for Paul, this is just key, is foundational to the gospel. It's like his one of the earliest proclamations of the gospel, that there's going to be somebody who comes to be united to his bride. And we are the bride. And because of that, then we are one flesh with him. But because we're one flesh with him, we're one flesh with each other. And that makes us a body. So Paul begins to use this in multiple ways, this imagery of the body. But you see that it, you know, it's a foundation of his gospel as he's preaching it. One critical thing about the body is that there is a rejection of conforming pressure, uniforming pressure. So, and we've talked about that before, that we have to be careful that we maintain the freedom of the individual, and that we respect it, we promote it. And part of that is, it's not just for the sake of the individual. I think it is. I think people cannot become what they're supposed to be if they're looking over their shoulder, they're trying, you know, to respond to some sort of a fear of negative consequences, whether it be rejection or just overt coercion in some way. But so we have to set people free for their own individual good, but we have to also set them free for the sake of this one flesh thing, you know, in that you have a, in the original one flesh, you have a heterogeneous union, you know. Really, and if you include God, it's very diverse, you know, and that celebrates the triune nature of God himself, as the Son is not the Father, and the Father is not the Spirit, and the Spirit is not the Son. You know, they have their unique place in the divine economy that is somewhat fixed. And so they are fully realized individuals who each as individuals freely give themselves to each other. And so this becomes the ideal for creation, really, for the expression of God in creation. Okay, so the body, in this case, the body becomes this picture of the divine, the spiritual union of the divine. My physical body depicts it to some degree, but my union with other people across various differences, you know, and those differences have to remain or else we don't see the body. So the body ethic would say diversity must be maintained, cultural diversity must be maintained, freedom must be defended and promoted among individuals. That's what the body ethic would say. The body ethic would also say that the individual members, that the things that they do have implications for the Lord himself, you know, that he's come to indwell them. And that what happens to my body, it has some effect on him, you know, whatever that means, right?
And on the other members.
Right. So I think maybe Paul had a very early introduction to this as, you know, before his conversion at the Damascus Road, Jesus says, what?
Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?
Right. Yeah. So where's, you know, where's Jesus at this time, right? He's somewhat untouchable, you know, he's at the right hand of God. And yet, Jesus says, you're attacking me. You know, I just wonder how that reverberated through Paul's consciousness the rest of his life, how he saw his union with Christ, you know, after his baptism, and then as he's reaching out to other believers and stuff, and he's just realizing the hurt that he caused to Christ by harming these people, but conversely now how he can serve Christ, how he can bring pleasure and joy to Christ through his body, his church. And so, you know, I'm sure that, this was something that Paul had to process a lot, and it became a kind of a foundational component, I think, to his understanding of the gospel. And Jesus famously, you know, throughout, especially the book of Matthew, but, you know, he says, if you give a cup of cold water to one of the least of these who believe in me, you did it to me. Mm-hmm. You know, come blessed of my Father, come and inherit, because I was sick and you know, and you came and visited me. I was in prison, you came and visited me, and I was naked and you clothed me and all this. Mm-hmm. Right now, what is that? How do we do that, Lord? And Jesus is here in his distressing disguise. So this body ethic, you know, it suggests that my encounters with other believers specifically has very powerful implications for how I should treat them, right? But then my union to Christ, as Paul says, you know, he talks about, so their ethic went on, and the Corinthians' ethic began as everything's lawful. Okay, so that's one. So why would you not have, you know, extramarital sex at a pagan temple? Well, because it's prohibited. I mean, that's why the Jews aren't doing it. You know, hey, Jews, why aren't you doing this? Okay, because it's prohibited. Okay, got it. You know, so we're not Jews. We're followers of Yahweh, but we're not prohibited like they are. So we're good, right? And then, no, you say, okay, I'm free to do anything. What is it that maybe I accept Paul's doctrine that not everything's helpful? You know, I say, okay, I'm free, but I don't want to engage in just, you know, anything.
That's the other half, by the way. Yeah. So all things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. Right. So that's the pairing of ideas.
Right. So I say, okay, Paul, yeah, maybe. So let's use your ethic. So not everything's lawful. I mean, everything's lawful, but not everything's helpful. Okay. So bacon and eggs. You know, eating breakfast. Yeah, depends on the day, right? You know, maybe today is good. Maybe you're intermittent fasting. I don't know. You know, maybe you're doing without for just to have money to give to somebody else. But you're free to do it. You're free to not to eat, right? Mm-hmm. So we would say, well, obviously this freedom ethic may have parameters. There may be things that my freedom, that I'm not free to do. So I'm not free to steal from you, right? Because then that would cause you harm, and, you know, it would cause me to probably have to hide something from the body. Yeah, you would be betrayed. It would hurt our relationship. It would hurt our witness out to the outside world. So I'm not free to steal from you. And I get that. And that's unhelpful. Okay. I'm not free to, you know, I don't know, come up with any horrible thing or whatever, right? Just to mug strangers or something. And so I get that. Thanks, Paul. You've helped me, right? But, you know, what is sexual satisfaction? You know, is it just fulfilling physical needs? I mean, you know, Paul, surely you didn't expect me to do without food and water. You know, I'm free to eat what I want. And he certainly has, and he will go on to in chapters 8 and 10, defend their right to eat, say, the meat at the pagan temple. So if you say, well, I can go down to the pagan temple and I can eat the meats that were sacrificed to idols because I'm hungry. Okay, and Jesus taught that what goes into the mouth doesn't defile a person, but what comes out. Mm-hmm. So fulfilling physical needs of these bodies doesn't really have an implication on my spiritual well-being or standing, my spiritual hygiene, pollution versus cleanliness, right? You see how they get there? You know, and mm-hmm. So they say food for the belly and the belly for food, mm-hmm. right? So you have a certain body part that God gave you or body parts that God gave you. And you have certain drives and desires that are woven into your physical being. and your physical being wants to satisfy these physical desires. And why is that wrong? Let's see how you get this argument. Now, I think to their credit, they actually went to the trouble to think things through, you know, to try to find it. But you see how crafty we are in that we can rationalize a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So when you set somebody free, they can rationalize. So that's why I think it's why it's critically important that we get a very robust understanding of the gospel, that we keep gospeling each other as we go.
Yeah.
You know, that the gospel, let the message of Christ dwell among you richly. It has to, because we just can't assume we tell somebody this story and they're just like radically changed and they're rejoicing and they're going on their way and everything's going to be great. Yes, I think that's true, but, you know, the author of the letter to the Hebrews says, you know, keep exhorting each other every day while it's called today, lest any of you be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. Sin will use the very ethic that is here to liberate you to follow Christ and to become the image of God, both individually and collectively, and turn that into something evil.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be careful that we, you know, and what we've been saying, that the gospel ethic is implicit and it's objective, that there are some things that the gospel prohibits out of hand. And so it's not all just situational. It is and it's not. You know. So Paul goes on and he says, but, you know, okay. And he doesn't argue with them. He doesn't refute this logic that food for the belly and the belly for food, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, and they're saying it's what it was made for, and so therefore it can be done. But he says, the body, however, is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's saying, look, your logic breaks down because, you know, your body wasn't made for, your body was made for a union. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that union is not, the prostitute and or the God that prostitute represents, right? But it is the Lord. So so now he begins to turn it on its head. And this gets to not just the body ethic, but it gets to this idea of ownership. And so he goes on and says, you know, don't you know that you're not your own? You're purchased with a price. So mm-hmm. Yeah, if you had not been born again, maybe your ethic works. You know, mm-hmm. But he's saying, no, you have, your body has been redeemed for the Lord,
mm-hmm.
You know, and so now if you then join your body to a prostitute, you know, that you've united what should be united and is united to Christ to a prostitute. Therefore, if you unite, you know, if you do that, You're basically violating the body ethic of one flesh, you know. So that's how he kind of reins back that without arguing directly with their logic. In either case, both when they say everything's lawful, he says, yes, that's true, but not everything's helpful. And then they say, well, the body's, you know, the stomach was made for food and food for the stomach and, you know, whatever, right? These body parts are supposed to together, go together in their desires, and that, you know, it's okay to do that. But he's saying, look, there's your logic's breaking down right there, because your, number one, your sexual desires are not, they don't define you. And I think that maybe is a critically important point, especially in our society today.
Mm-hmm. You know, your body is not for sexual morality,
right.
But for the Lord. So there's right. there's a gospel ethic there is an ethic in the gospel, is what we're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that in his statement, the body is for the Lord. In other
right.
words, you were redeemed
mm-hmm.
to belong to the Lord, to be the Lord's slave. Like in Romans 6, Paul says, you've come out of slavery to sin, now you're enslaved to God.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a new slavery.
Right.
So you're free from the law, you're free from religion. in this context, 1 Corinthians context, you're free from the law. All things are lawful, but you've been freed in order to serve the Lord. Mm-hmm. Your body is for the Lord.
Right.
You've been united with Him.
Right. So you're free because you were purchased by Him, right? Mm-hmm. But you were purchased by Him for Him, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, your freedom can't be an argument to then enslave yourself or to entangle yourself in something that doesn't honor Him.
Uh-huh.
That would be nonsensical, uh-huh. right? And so that's Paul's argument is, and so he doubles down on freedom, right? And, uh-huh. and he's pointing that expediency ethic toward the Lord. He's saying, look, this is the goal, is that your body would be united to His body, and that what you do in your body has implications for His body, the people of God, and for Him. You know, that this union to Him in the body, it does tether me, it does call me to a holiness in my body. Uh-huh. And that was the error of the Gnostic cults and the libertine movements like the Nicolaitans and others, that they taught doesn't matter. They were dualistic. They were kind of fusing some Platonic thought with the Christian teaching. And they said, you know, it doesn't matter what you do in your body. Your body doesn't have anything to do with your spiritual self. Uh-huh. So, you know, some would say, well, the body is to be punished because it's a part of the physical realm, and the physical realm is inherently evil. So they would take Paul's teaching on the flesh and say that the body needs to be punished because it's evil. Okay. And Paul says, no, I mean, the body is created for God. It is the medium through which we worship the Lord, and, you know, we offer Him praise and sacrifices. That eating and enjoying food and giving Him thanks gives Him glory, that there's something good about the body, that it shouldn't be punished for its own sake, mm-hmm. right? At the same time, that the body is not, that we don't inhabit these bodies so that the bodies can set the direction, mm-hmm. that the body is to be subject to the Spirit. And so these bodies are to be set apart for the Lord. And so what we do in the body does matter, but it is not that it is evil, that we can glorify God in our bodies. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we should do, right? So I think 1 Thessalonians 4 does a great job, and maybe we're kind of covering the idea of sexual immorality. We may skip this topic, but maybe we'll riff on it. I don't know. But, you know, he talks about in 1 Thessalonians 4, and I like 1 Thessalonians because if it's not the earliest of Paul's letters, it's the second earliest, it seems. So if you remember in Acts 17, and he goes through Thessalonica and he's run out of town, and it seems that he writes back to them pretty quickly. He was only there for 3 weeks, right, before he's run out of town, and so he's left a church there, and he's been gone long enough that he's heard that this church is flourishing. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, thrilling to him. It should be thrilling to us. It really is a testament, the power of the gospel, to really change people. I mean, he celebrates this in 1 Thessalonians 1 when he says, our gospel came to you not simply with words but also with power, you know, that, and you became imitators of us and of the Lord. Right. And the Lord's message rang out from you. And so that there's this this work that the word is doing inside of these people. It's actually having an effect. Now, he reminds them of pretty much one specific, you know, it's kind of like he doesn't have a whole lot of notes for them. I think he's just so very pleased with the fact that the gospel has continued to have this positive result. But he does remind them of this one thing in 1 Thessalonians 4, he says, well, you know what instructions we gave you, verse 2, by the authority of the Lord Jesus, it is God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid sexual immorality, that each of you should learn to, this one, the NIV says, control your own body, but I think the Greek, it says, possess your own body, mm-hmm. in a way that is holy and honorable, not in passionate lust like the pagans who do not know God. And in this matter, no one should wrong or take advantage of a brother or sister, the Lord will punish all those who commit such sins, as we told you and warned you before. For God did not call us to be impure, but to live a holy life. So I think that this is him further kind of expositing this ethic about holiness versus sexual immorality. But, you know, he's talking about having ownership of your body versus your body having ownership of you.
Mm-hmm. And he says that we've been called not to live an impure life, but to live a holy life. So right. There's there again, this calling to Christ is a calling to a certain kind of life.
Right. Right. And, you know, and he talks about that, that we should avoid these things so that none of us should defraud our spiritual siblings. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that this has to do with what he's saying in 1 Corinthians 6. You know, I've wondered this, and it's just like, I think we all deserve to be a part of a body that is where everyone is contributing, mm-hmm. you know. So somebody who is going and stepping out and doing this, that has an effect on the rest of us. You know, it has an effect on the way we are seen in the society if we're trying to preach this gospel of holiness and stuff. It has an effect on the fact that I'm shouldering a load by contributing to the body through holiness, and you're not. And so, you know, all of us are throwing our resources, our energies, you know, into the pot in the middle, right? Mm-hmm. And one of us, or maybe a few of us, come and we act like we are, you know, kind of like Ananias and Sapphira, that we're going to like, yeah, of course, we're all part of this, woohoo! But, you know, as soon as we get the chance, we're not part of it. Mm-hmm. We're not suffering with the rest of the group. You know, we're not contributing to this body that is predicated on holiness. We're siphoning off those energies to something else. And I think that's why he says that we shouldn't defraud our brethren. It's not so much that they were committing sexual immorality with other Christians. That could be the case. But it does seem, if this was similar, and I think Thessalonica was probably very similar to Corinth in the culture, mm-hmm. that it's simply what Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians 6, that you're uniting the body to a prostitute. You know, that what you're doing has implications for the rest of the group. Even though you're doing it as an individual, you're spiritually united to the group. And so...
So you're defrauding them.
You're defrauding them, right. So, you know, and it's something that I think these arguments try to make this sort of a thing mainstream, but if it's something that, you know, you wouldn't do in front of the group or wouldn't want the whole group to know about, probably shouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying it's about conformity, but I'm just saying it's probably a decent litmus test to just say, look, I'm going to live in the light. Mm-hmm. Anything that I feel like I have to hide from the body, probably something I just don't need to do, you know what I'm mm-hmm. saying? It's just like there are very few things we absolutely have to do, mm-hmm. you know? I think we have to stay warm or, you know, keep our body temperature a certain place, right? And we have to eat maybe 2,000 calories a day, maybe 1,500, you know? And we have to drink water and we have to breathe and that's it, right? And we can come to kind of conflate other desires with something we just absolutely have to have. Mm-hmm. But when we do that, then I think that we are beginning to lose the agency over ourselves. Mm-hmm. When we begin to see things as needs that are wants. Mm-hmm. And we defraud ourselves, I think, of the opportunity to subdue the flesh. And it's not through severe treatment, intentionally going out of our ways to cause it harm, but just by making the best decision, mm-hmm. you know, because that's what we keep. I think that is another indicator that we're sliding and that we need to stop is when we say, well, it's not wrong for me to, mm-hmm. you know, once we start aiming at what's not wrong to do, we're probably beginning to justify our behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're pursuing what's best And those inclinations are natural if we have a healthy devotional life. If we're really pursuing the Lord, then we begin to just think, you know, I don't need to buy a new car. My car works great. I bet I could use this money for, you know, support somebody or to do good and maybe just to do outreach. Or, you know, we just begin to naturally be polarized towards something. And, you know, someone may be free to buy a new car, but when we begin to seek the best, then we start just making different decisions naturally, I think. And, you know, if we could assume, and this would be kind of cool, you know, if we were in a body where everybody's seeking the best, uh-huh. You know, what would that be like? I mean, do you think people would want to be a part of that group? So, if you're in a group where people are not seeking the best, or maybe a couple are, and most are not, that there's a degree to which everybody's being defrauded from the kingdom of God, the experience of it. You know, I mean, we read Acts mm-hmm. 2 and 4 and we say, wouldn't that be great? Mm-hmm. And then we're like, okay, start. Mm-hmm. She's like, no. I mean, it would be great, but I'm not going to do that. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, because that's the only place it could ever happen is if the individual, you know, each individual is just already polarized in that direction. And that gets back to the body ethic. When we get to this idea of giving, generosity, right? And Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians 8 and the collection for the Lord's people, and that this is an experience of grace collectively. You know, the generosity is an experience of this wealth from God. So, you know, if I'm not in a body that's like that, I've been defrauded. But maybe it's because I'm defrauding, you know, because I'm withholding. Or maybe I'm afraid of being defrauded and I'm not going to do it until you do it, you know. But I think that the one who has truly been dealt with by the gospel doesn't see it as a matter of accounts. You know, they're joyful. They're happy to give. Like, you know, Paul points out that the Macedonian church was. He just talks about it, their extreme poverty they gave, you know, not only what they could afford, but even beyond that, you know. And Paul is rejoicing because this is a moment of grace, that these are people who are not just parting with material wealth, but who have assigned value to non-material wealth and are the beneficiaries of that decision, you know. And so he's like, you know, you could have this too, right? And then he brings up this notion, and I'll have to probably put it in the notes later, but there it is. In 2 Corinthians 8, he says in verse 14, and he's speaking of the church in Jerusalem, and there's this famine, and so people are in Jerusalem and that area are doing without. This collection's all about sending to that Jerusalem church, right? And he says that at the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn, their plenty will supply what you need. Now, he's not speaking of, well, let me back up a little bit. In verse 13, he says, our desire is not that others might be relieved while you are hard pressed, but that there might be equality. Whoa. Mm. Right? Now we're on a slippery slope, Nathan. Yeah, call me Pinko, right? Because what's he saying? What's the implication there? You know, and then he quotes from Scripture. Well, he says, at the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn, their plenty, and I think that here he means their spiritual wealth, that in Jerusalem there were, you know, there was knowledge of Torah and of the gospel that was really go pouring out into the world. And this is prophecy. Prophecy said that the wealth of the nations would flood in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem would, you know, the knowledge of the Lord would pour out of Jerusalem. So here they are. They're kind of fulfilling prophetic utterance. Right. And so, and he says, so that in turn their plenty will supply what you need. The goal is equality. As it is written, the one who gathered much did not have too much, and the one who gathered little did not have too little. You remember that, where that is? It's a test, Bible test.
Where in the Bible that comes from?
Yeah, yeah. He's quoting, the one who gathered much did not have too much, and the one who gathered little did not have too little. You don't have to give me the verse. You can just give me the instance.
I don't have to give you the verse.
No. Yeah, just the story just where that occurs. Yeah. It's a toughie, right? Yeah, I know.
Nope.
It's in Exodus 16 with the giving of the instructions related to manna and the Sabbath. And so the Lord, you know, he says, I'm going to test the Israelites as they go out, you know. And so he tells Moses, because the people are out there, and if only we died by the Lord's hands in Egypt, there we sat by the pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. Right? And so the Lord says, you know, I'm gonna rain down bread from heaven, and the people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. Mm-hmm. And in this way, I will test them to see whether they will follow my instructions. I like that. Mm-hmm. Because the instruction is gather enough for today. Mm-hmm. Think about what kind of test that is. You know, if we just go out and there's a whole buffet, you know, that just appears in the desert, and you don't know if it's going to show up again tomorrow. You know, what is everything in you screaming to do? You know, get a 5 gallon bucket, you know, load it up with General Chow's chicken for today, tomorrow, and maybe next week. And so this is really a call to this life of faith very early. As soon as Israel leaves Egypt, I mean, this is before the Sinai moment and the giving of the law, Exodus 16, and everybody's hungry. And God's like, I'm going to give you food, but collect enough for today. Take an omer, this measure, and collect an omer for every person. So basically, get one person's portion every day. And that's the test, right? And then he goes on, and so they go out and they do that. And then, let's see here, the bread. So, they were grumbling against the Lord. Now, this was all the quail and stuff. At any rate, as he goes on, and let me just get back to where I was in that passage in 2 Corinthians, because that'll give me the exact reference. You know, he talks about how that they gathered, everyone gathered as much as they needed, so that there was nobody who had, you know, surplus, and there was nobody who had need. Mm-hmm. And this wilderness community almost becomes the archetype for what he thinks Christians should be, you know. So Exodus 16:18 is where it says that the one that gathered much did not have too much, and the one that gathered little did not have too little. Mm-hmm. So Paul sees this as normative for the society, for the body, that when God is providing, that we're trending toward equality. Mm-hmm. Now, this doesn't mean that we have to divest everything. I mean, obviously there were rich Christians and poor Christians in the first century. There were, you know, you have Philemon and Onesimus famously. So Onesimus remains a slave. Philemon remains a householder. At the same time, Paul sows the seed of that equality by saying, receive him back, not as a slave, but as a brother. Mm-hmm. What? You know? You know, there's a real naivete to think that there's this flattening in every society, because people who are not a part of the new community are not worthy of that, to be frank. You know, if I, let's say somebody out there in our town, we have a lot of people who stand at intersections with cardboard signs. Mm-hmm. And I'm driving by, and let's say I'm a multimillionaire. Mm-hmm. And I say, hey, get in the car. I'm going to change your life. You're never going to stand on the street corner again. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you know, they're reticent, but, you know, I'm driving a fancy car. I'm in an Escalade or something. It looks like, you know, it looks like I can do what I say I'm going to do. So they get in, they're curious, right? And I say, okay, you know, how did you get out here? Why are you here? Oh, well, you know, I came here. My cousin told me he had a job for me and, you know, mm-hmm. you know the story. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, my house burned down. I don't have a car and I don't have a birth certificate. I'm starting work in 2 weeks, but, you know, I got to live until then and et cetera. Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's say that, you know, I'm rich enough to believe everything that the person says. And I say, all right, well, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to buy you a starter home with cash. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a nice little neighborhood. It's going up. I'm a developer. And one of my houses that I'm building is, you know, it's here. And it was under contract, but it fell through. And now I'm going to get a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house in a nice little new neighborhood. And, you know, you can move your family in there. And I'm going to get you a job with my company. And I'm going to take out a loan for a used car in your name. And I'm going to pay you plenty so that you can make your car payment. And this is just part of me. I'm just going to go around. I'm going to do this with everybody standing on the street corner mm-hmm. until I'm living about middle income. Mm-hmm. You think that's going to work?
No, I don't. I don't think that your point is that this person is not equipped and prepared to actually live this, you know, take care of this house, pay the bills on this house. You know, they're not
the job.
Yeah, keep whatever the job. It is. Yeah.
So this isn't a call toward communism. Communism just frankly doesn't work. This is a call to the body, to the community. And so there is the already and not yet resident in our community of life. But we ought to be trending that way among ourselves. Mm-hmm. That the people who maybe are the recipients of this kindness are accountable to the body. Mm-hmm. You know, that we're like, wait, what are you doing? You know, your brother, he set you up. He gave you this. He bought you a new start. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. It's incumbent on that person to go to work, mm-hmm. to work with his hands so that he might have to give, right? To contribute. They aren't, it's just not an option for them just to receive and to waste and to blow it. That there's very much an ethic built into that moment. Mm-hmm. And so you see this kind of interconnectedness that by showing kindness to this person, I'm also making it incumbent on them to begin to rise, to begin to take on new habits and to shed destructive patterns. And now what begins to happen is this kingdom starts to come in. Now, let's say that this person really is. It's like, look, I'm just going to get to middle income at some point. But it's going to take them 20 years to get there. You know, that's fine. But you think about all the flowers that are growing up along the path. You know, mm-hmm. just the joy that's breaking forth, the redemption that's happening. I mean, folks, really all we have to do is find some single moms. I don't think it would ever be a bad idea if you have a believing single mom. I don't think you're ever wasting your resources as long as that person loves and is raising their kids. Mm-hmm. You know, if you support them 100%, you have the means, and you just say, I'm going to pay your utilities and your house payment. And, you know, whatever you get from your ex, or, you know, maybe if you don't have an ex, maybe you have 3 kids by 3 dads and they're all deadbeats and they're gone. But, you know, you've come to Christ and you're wanting to live for him. Mm-hmm. And I just say, you know, and your kids are 8, 5, and 3. And I just say, why don't you take care of your house, pray, you know, participate in the church, and just raise your kids for the next 15 years. And I'll pay your house payment and your utilities. There are people who are positioned to do that. They wouldn't even notice it. Mm-hmm. Who are believers. You know? Would that be a bad thing? Maybe, but it would be incumbent on this woman to live a godly life, to put her kids first. And if she does get married, then maybe, you know, that there is a believer, you know, in the church and somebody. I mean, you begin to see that the idea of finding somebody on Tinder and marrying them would be just like, that would just never enter the picture for this woman who is very much now married to the church because of the generosity of this individual believer. And so that there becomes an ethic that's incumbent on her, you know, put her kids first, worship God, you know, if you marry, marry in the Lord, you know, so that you can alleviate maybe the demand on this person. They can give it to somebody else now. You know, that's all incumbent on somebody as we're encouraging them to grow, this woman to grow, you know, but also her kids, you know, her kids are being benefited by having their mom present. I mean, hey, they only have one parent, you know, if that parent's got to work all the time, they really only have like 0.3 parents, you know?
Right.
So, there's just so many great outlets. And I think that that's what the body ethic calls us to do. And that's why we don't need that. Go ahead. Are we done?
We're done. The body ethic is what we discussed today, y'all. And if you got questions about it, maybe you want to continue the conversation, you can always email us, discussion@recoverfaith.org. Thanks. We'll see you next time.